that it the recording works. Okay, now it's recording again. So hopefully we didn't lose anything. The program just crashed and there's not much to do. At least the Zoom is converting the file. So I think as it is recording again, we can continue with the R again. So we ended the second stage that we started to think about the possibility that the ARMA 1.1 model might be the data generating process. So in the third stage, we are doing the diagnostics for this series. So basically what we will do is that we first will save all the residuals of every series, or we estimated 3 ARMA models for Eurostoxx. So let's save all their residuals. And then we assume that the true underlying model is linear. So in this case, when we look at the variance of these residuals, it says the smaller the variance, meaning the smaller the mean squared error in the OLS estimation, the better the linear fit. So we'll compare them, and according to these results, just by comparing the variances, it would say that the ARMA 1.2 model is the best. But from earlier, we had really hard time with this model, so we shouldn't believe this result too firmly. And basically, if we look at the values of 25.5 and 26, and can basically compare the relative difference between the values, we get a result that the residual in the ARMA 1.1 model is only 1.7% smaller than in the ARMA 1.2 model. So basically, that's not a big difference. If you can remember, so what I did here is basically the same comparison like in the first demonstration session. It was I can't recall what was the demonstration, but just calculating the relative difference of the values, we get a result that there's not much difference with the ARMA 1.1 model and ARMA 1.2 model in terms of variance. So we could continue here and apply our principle of parsimony and think that it is better to continue with the ARMA 1.1 model. Then let's just calculate let's just check the possibility of the autocorrelation. So in a Ljung-Box test, the null hypothesis is that there is no autocorrelation at the lac here 20. That's our null. And when we compare the test statistic with the probability distribution, we get a pretty high p-value implying that the null stays in power, meaning there is no autocorrelation to series. And then let's check the same thing for the US stocks. Here we are only using 2 different models, ARMA 2.1 and ARMA 1.1. So let's save their residuals and compare them. And here we see that ARMA 1.1 model performs better also in terms of variance. Then let's check the autocorrelation, the residuals. And again, the null is no autocorrelation. We look at the p-value, it's over 0.05. So this implies, in this case, the null stays in power, and we conclude, or we have found more support that there is no autocorrelation in the series. And then let's check the same thing for the VIX. So there are actually no alternatives. This is just the value for the residuals, and let's check if there's any autocorrelation. The null is no autocorrelation, and then from the p-value again, we see that the null stays in power. There is no autocorrelation. So from diagnostics, we can make a conclusion that ARMA 1-1 model seems to be the best starting point for further research. So to strengthen our assumption that it is truly the case that ARMA 1-1 model is the underlying process, let's next turn into forecasting.
Yep. Before you go to the forecasting, can I discuss a little bit the points you covered in Stata? Because like there are quite a lot of differences.
Yeah, sure.
Thank you.
So can you share your screen?
Yes. Here is my screen. So first of all, compared to R, in Stata, there is no option of automatic lock order selection for ARMA model. But that's not a big issue because autocorrelation and partial autocorrelation graphs are more actually informative in Stata, and it's possible to make predictions based on graphs about the luck order for the ARMA model. But this basically means that you will find an optimal luck structure for ARMA specification just by iterating over different combinations of R and MA lucks. And for that, you can use the following set of criteria I've written. So the first one is that a simpler luck structure of ARMA model is preferred over a more complex luck structure of the model. The second one is that significance of coefficients of R and MA lucks, like they should be significant. If they are not significant, like it doesn't make sense to include them into the model. Also, you should look at the overall significance of the model, and the smaller the information criteria, the better the quality of the model regarding the residuals. We can say that the smaller is the variance of the residuals, the better is the model. So yeah, you can use autocorrelation and partial autocorrelation graphs to make hypotheses about possible ARMA luck structure, and number of R lucks is defined as a number of significant lucks of partial autocorrelation function, and Q number of MA lucks is defined as a number of significant lacks of autocorrelation function. So let's use the example of VIX series and let's look at the autocorrelation and partial autocorrelation functions once again. So here I'm running the code. And yeah, here is the graph. So based on autocorrelation graph, we can say that there should be for sure one MA lag in our model. And if we look at the partial autocorrelation function, here we can say that we can try to include one R lag into the model, or maybe three, because here is it's also out of confidence interval. So let's get back to the code. Let's estimate ARMA 1.1 for the risk indicator VIX and predict the residuals and check for their variation. So by writing the command ARIMA VIX and specifying the order 101, we're getting the following results. Here are the results. And the first thing which I really like in Stator is that you don't have to calculate the t-statistic for the coefficients because it's actually is already calculated here in the table, and you can even see the p-value of the coefficient. So here it means that the first R-lag is actually significant, and MLAC is also significant. It's only that the constant is not significant in this model, so maybe we could think of excluding it in the future from the model. So here is line 96, and if we run it, can see their now we can see their information criteria of the model here. Archaic is information criterion and Bayesian information criterion. Let's predict the residuals of the model just by writing predict and the name of the residuals, and then residuals. And then let's find out the variation of the residuals by just typing the summary extensive statistics of our residual series. So yeah, from this table, you can get the variance of the residuals. And now let's run the model ARMA 3.1 also and compare the results. So here is the model ARMA 3.1, and here we can see that actually the second and the third RLACs are not significant, so it doesn't make sense to include them into the model. And also, if you look into the information criteria of this model, so archaic is equal to this value, and Yeah, the information criteria for the ARMA 1.1 is less, so this indicates that actually ARMA 1.1 is a better model for VAX series. And also, if we look at the variance of ARMA 3.1 model, it's a bit higher than variance of the residuals of ARMA 1.1 model. Again, saying that ARMA 1.1 model is actually better in describing the behavior of VAX series. Yep, and here you can also do the Lewin-Box test for to check the presence of autocorrelation in the residual series. Here I'm doing it for the residuals of ARMA 1.1 model because it like looks better. So here it's important to specify after BP. BP means box pierce. It's important to specify small. This will give you the Lewin box statistics, but if you won't specify small, it will give you the box pierce statistics. And let's run this code also. Yep. And here's the output of the test. And on the left side, we can see their the statistics for autocorrelation up to some lag, like, I mean, up to second lag, third lag, fourth lag, or fifth lag. And on the right side of the table, you can see the statistic calculated for separate lags, for first lag, second, third, fourth, and so on. And yeah, the null hypothesis is that there is no autocorrelation in the residual series. And just looking at the p-value, we can say that up to 20s lag, there is for sure no autocorrelation in the residual series because the p-value is really high. Yep, I think yeah, that's all I wanted to share about this part. So Juha, you can continue with the forecasting exercise.
Yes, thank you. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's good thing to repeat these things multiple times because it's when they're repeated, it's easily more easily stuck into the mind.
Yep, sure.
Should we test if the residuals are normally distributed or not, or does it matter?
It doesn't matter. Here it doesn't matter because we are assuming that this is a large sample. We're doing large sample estimation and not small sample estimation. And in the large sample estimation, the sample mean converges to the, for example, the population mean by the law of large number, and or at the same time that the distribution of the variable or vector converges into the normal distribution only approximately by applying the central limit theorem. So basically what this says is that normal distribution does never apply, and we are only using results that are approximately normal. So this means that there's a like in the case of a characteristic equation earlier, I mentioned that although our distributions are not perfectly the same, there's an equivalence between these distributions. So we can apply our approximations as if it were normal distributions. It is interpreted like a normal distribution. For example, normal distribution doesn't have the fat tails like in our distribution. But if you want to use or test the normality of the distribution, you could, of course, you can do it, and it can say something. Although then in this case you have to interpret the details of the test. For example, it could be the case that the normality could imply that there's some skewness in the distribution. So you could use it, but per se, these distributions we are dealing with are never normal distributions. Normal distribution makes two restrict assumptions. So I'll write it here one time. Large sample properties. So let's start the forecasting part. So in the question sheet, we're asked to calculate two subsamples defined there, and then to start test out of sample forecast accuracy. So let's start by defining our first subsample. So here, this defines our subsample. I use a Windon function. VIX is the series in question, like what we are asked to study more in detail. And then I define the start date and the end date. So now we have our subsample, and then we'll also save our two values that have happened, and this is the values after August 2008, meaning from September till the end of the year of 2010. So these are the two values so that we can compare our forecasts to these realized values. So that's our first subsample, and then we'll take the calculate the second subsample at the same time. So from September 2009 till the end of the year 2019, and then the forecasting period, that means the last year. Two values that were realized last year. Let's calculate them. And let's start performing our forecast for the first subsample. So first we'll do the Dirac or static forecast. So first of all, we specify our model, the order we want to estimate our subsample. And we're using the OLS method. So we'll calculate that. And then next we calculate our predicted values. And these are needed in the forecast. We'll calculate them. And then in the third place, we want to calculate our confidence intervals. So this is the lower part of the confidence interval, and here below is the upper part of the confidence interval. Let's save them. And then we'll start plotting. So let's take the subsample of our predicted series and plot it there. So basically, this is our static forecast here. So it begins somewhere around value minus 10, or and then the value starts to decrease to zero. That after some time, it converges to zero, and then it's just zero afterwards. So basically, what's happening here is that after a few observations, the memory of our series, meaning the MI1 root in our series, is activated, and when the process starts to remember itself, it starts to converge to zero. Meaning that the variance decreases and the series become over time more constant. Then we'll start adding, then we're at this, these are the realized values, meaning these are just the log differences of the series. And then we'll add our confidence intervals. So overall, we can see that our static forecast seems to be converging to the mean value of the realized series our realized series is bouncing up and below the static predicted value. Do you, Alexandra, want to say something about forecasting is data?
Well, I think I will add in the end.
Okay, I think that's better also. So let's go to recursive forecasting, and then just please stop me and I'll stop sharing the screen. So next, the recursive forecasting. So basically, what has been written here, this for is a loop that it loops. Basically, what this loop does is that it takes a sample as given, and first it predicts the first value after this sample, and then it adds this realized value into this sample, and then predicts the second value in the second value after the sample. So it's a loop that extends the sample window. So let's just run it through and make this series as a time series. Next, let's start plotting the lines again. Let's take the predicted values. This is our static forecast. This is our recursive forecast. So that in itself doesn't say much, but let's add first realized values, so they're bouncing around there, and then let's add the limits. And let's end that you can see what the series are referring to. So from here, we can see that our static forecast is actually behaving better than our recursive forecast. And why this is the case, look at the line here. It seems that the recursive forecast is inversely related to the realized value, meaning that whenever the realized value is going down, the forecast is going up. So it says that this seems to be pretty bad forecast, and our static forecast perform, and hence our static forecast performs better than our predicted forecast. So why is this the case that our recursive forecast behave so badly? Let's look at the estimation of our model. From here, we can see that this negative relationship is due to our MI1 variable. We see immediately here, just by dividing the value of the MI1 parameter by the standard error, the t-value is higher than the 2, so that this is statistically significant. So we can see here that when the memory of the forecast is activated, it goes into the wrong direction as the realized value. And this means that due to this moving average lag, our recursive estimation isn't as efficient as our static one. And as our memory is really short, referring here that we are only using the first lag as memory, that means the previous month value. This implies that when we are doing this, this overemphasizes the meaning of the previous month. But because just by eyeballing the series is not enough, and we should rather rely on statistical tests to be more certain about this. So let's run some tests. So here, this is the accuracy of the. First subsample, and then we are comparing it with the accuracy of the forecast. So we are comparing here the statics forecasts to the forecasts of the recursive model. And here the basic idea is that looking at the mean error, residual mean squared error, mean absolute error, mean percentage error, and mean absolute percentage error, the model that has the lower value performs the better. So comparing this value mean error to this mean error. Right now, I can't remember. Is it the case that the absolute value is here? The absolute value is here the important thing, meaning. I believe it should be the absolute values here, the value in question, because it's written that it's only the this value is lower in the recursive model than this value than this values in the static model, meaning here that every other value is performs according to these statistics better better than in the recursive model. So this strengthens our conclusion that the static model is better. And then let's look at the end, the Thiel's value. And here the critical thing is that this value should be, Thiel's value should be below one. And this means that when the Thiel's value is below one, the ratio of the residual mean squared errors of the model compared to the residual mean squared of the naive model, and this naive model refers in this case, so to say, to a third model that is just a basic martingale model. That means that when we compare in this first case this model to a model where there's no change in the dependent value, a dependent variable. When this value is below zero, this form performs better than the pure martingale model. And the martingale model means that best prediction of the tomorrow's value is today. So that's a naive forecast to say, or I'll write it here mathematically as it's more easier to see what's the case. So the martingale model, or the model with naive forecast, says that when we predict tomorrow, the best prediction for this is just the value of today. Mean to say it another way, there is no change between tomorrow. The best prediction of tomorrow is that there is no change tomorrow. So that's the naive forecast. And as our value is below one, this model performs better than the naive forecast. And from the second model, meaning the recursive model, as this value is above one, this model actually performs worse than the naive forecast. So like we see in this picture, we'd forecast the future value better just by looking at the tomorrow forecast would be better with hit. On average, we'd hit better right if we just look today's value than just try to guess what tomorrow is. And these values are good in the sense that they are not too much below one, meaning that they're not like 0.1 or something like that, because if that be the case, we could assume that there's a strong trend happening in the series that we are not taking into account.
Yep, and I would like to share this point about forecast instead.
Yes.
So yeah, it's also possible to do the static and recursive forecasts in Stator, but in Stator there is no option of using a CSS method. So Stator is using maximum likelihood. And actually, with the maximum likelihood method, the results of the forecast are even worse than in R. Here we can see that we can see the dynamic forecast, which is more like a forecast of the mean of the actual series, and the static forecast is unlike in R, like is trying to replicate the dynamics of actual series, but really badly. So it's also possible to calculate the root mean squared error of the forecast. And here is the root mean squared error of the direct forecast, and this is for the recursive forecast, and both of them are higher in values than those in R, meaning that CSS method actually gives better coefficient estimates and better forecasts for VAX series, but still, like, even like in R, the forecast is far from perfect. So yeah, Juha, you can continue now. Thank you.
Yes. So for the first subsample, we got the result that a static forecast performs better than the recursive forecast. So then let's run the same estimations for the second subsample. So first, the static forecast. There's our model, ARMA. There's our model, ARMA 1.1. This zero here is the integrated value referring to the integrated root of the, when we want to take the integrated root into account in our modeling. But here we are only using autoregressive and moving average roots. So basic AR root is one and MI root is one. And then we are using OLS estimation again. So let's run our estimation. And this estimation was for the subsample that begins on the September 2009 till December 2019. And then we'll need the predicted values for the forecasts. And these predicted values are point estimates, meaning only individual values. To say this in another way, so we are taking just individual mean values, but we could also specify our model in such a way that we would make all forecasts like within the confidence interval. But here we are only taking, we are only forecasting with individual values, values in time. Then we now need our confidence interval. There, and then let's start plotting. This is our forecast, and it looks pretty similar like the one in the first subsample. It becomes a little bit below zero, but when the memory, meaning the MI root, and we could actually write it here. Again, we have a MI root that is negative and it is statistically significant. So it performs similarly like in the first subsample, And let's compare that with the realized values with of the fixed subsample. And those are the realized values. And those are confidence intervals, and let's plot the legend. So we have a similar result like before, that over time our series converges to the mean of the sample. And this happens when the memory is activated. And then let's calculate our recursive forecasts. Applying the same loop procedure code as before. And then let's plot these values. First the static value, then the recursive value, then the realized value, confidence interval, and the legend. And similarly, to the negative sign of the MI coefficient, we see that this recursive forecast is inversely related to the realized values. Basically, saying the same as before, that our static forecast is performing better than the realized forecast. But let's still test our forecast and compare them. So these are the stats for the static model, and these are the stats for the recursive model. And again, we'll see that static model has lower values than the recursive models. Again, the difference is here the mean absolute error. The mean percentage error, like in the previous case, is lower in the recursive model, implying here that four out of five stats say that static model is better. But here we have an interesting result. So both of these Thiel's values for both of these tests are above one. And when this is the case, the naive forecast, meaning the martingale property, I'll write it again here, the martingale property. The expected value of tomorrow, the best prediction to it is today's values, meaning that best forecast is the forecast that there is no change between today or tomorrow. So this means that in the both of these cases, this naive forecast is better than the forecast that the model gives us. Yeah, this tells value for the static model, well, it's basically the one. But in general, still we can, just by comparing the statics model's tails value to the recursive model's tails value, we see, as this value is lower than these values, that the static model is also performs better in this case. So possibly what we have been doing here in the second subsample, that we have taken the 10-year period before the corona crisis began last year and forecasting the events or the events of the corona crisis by the 10 years period before it, we'll actually get something we economically suppose will happen, that during the corona period, markets were run by fear, and this implies that there are a lot of outlier observations realizing during this period, that it is no wonder that when we try to forecast such extreme values by the values that are from more stable economic period, that we get these bad results. And most probably this is the case, that we're using a model that forgets what's happening in the past after 1 month. The model loses its memory. So in the end, we arrive in a conclusion that we should try to understand corona period by using something else than the last 10 years before the period. We probably would get better results, but let's leave that. And then finally, we're going into sixth exercise, and this will be a lot quicker than the one earlier. There are a lot of similar things said, like I said in the fourth and fifth exercise, so I'll speed up a little bit. So first, let's clear our global environment, then load the libraries needed. And then let's start by importing the data. Just a minor note here, I sent you an announcement in the Moodle that there was a wrong R file, and that was due to the case that it specified the end value as the October 2020 and not the December 2020. So here, this is corrected. And then we have our spread series, and this spread series is the difference of the 10-year US government bond minus the 3-month US bill. So let's make that into a time series. And then let's look at the summary stats. So this is our this is histogram for the spread series, that it looks a little bit negatively skewed, meaning that the probability mass is on the right hand side, but the shape of this histogram looks more belly shape than the histograms used earlier. here we can see that the mean, median, the mean are almost the same, and the first comparing the 25% and 75% limits to the mean. Yeah, it's they are like minus 0.9 plus 0.9. So it's pretty symmetric distribution. Then let's plot the series. This is the realized values. And let's draw a line to the zero of the u-axis. From here, we can see what is interesting here, that when the series becomes negative, it means that the markets are valuing the short-term interest rate more highly than the longer-term interest rate. So there are different cases when the yield curve inverts. And most recently, it has been the case since around September 2019. And then again in doing 1 year ago when the corona crisis began. We also see from here that the series seems to be almost like mean reverting till like 2000, mean reverting till like 2010, and afterwards it has been more or less drifting downwards, but it has not increased again. And actually, if we interpret it, what has happened here, meaning why this series spread is increasing here, for example, from 2002 till 2015, the spread has been higher because Fed had the same, meaning the Central Bank of the United States put its effective rate close to the zero. It was either plus 1% or plus 2%. And then the longer term yields were higher, so the spread was higher. And then when the Fed started to increase its effective rates, it was also seen in the spread, that is, it started to decrease. And then again, when the great financial crisis broke through 2008, the spread started to increase. But then afterwards, the long-term yields have only been decreasing. Or I should say it in a better way. Fed started to increase its effective rate. That was tapering began. Fed started to taper its quantitative easing program December 2013. So it gave the market a signal that they're looking more normal monetary policy. And then they began to increase their effective rate December 2015, and afterwards the series has, the spread has decreased. And then again, after the corona period, they put their effective rate to zero, and the spread has increased something, but not as drastically as before. So in the B part, let's start estimating our model. So we won similar Aalto-Arima function, like in the previous exercise, to look what could be the optimal lag for the data generating process. Using the Akaike information criteria, we arrive at that ARMA 2.0 is the optimal model, but using Schwarz information criteria, we have ARMA 1.2. So let's then look if we can get rid of the second autoregressive route, AR2 route. So let's run a regression. And now we're estimating spread with AR2 model, and we're using the OLS as our estimation method. And from here, we can see that when we look at the standard error of the AR1 coefficient, we see that it is highly significant, but the AR2 coefficient seems not to be significant. So applying the principle of the parsimonity, we could ask that maybe we can run do as good without the second route. We don't have to add additional complexity to our model. That simple model could be also perform as good. So let's run AR1 model. We're getting more nice result that if we look at the compare this model below to the model above that has two autoregressive lags, we see if we subtract the second AR lag from the first one, we get around the value in the model below. So 1.1281 minus 0.0594 is something about 0.9703. It's approximately similar value. At the same time, we see that our intercept increases a little bit, but it also stays statistically significant. But usually when it is the case that the standard error is so low and the AR1 lag is so close to one, we could start thinking about the possibility that there could be a unit route in this process that we are not taking into account in our estimates when we are estimating our AR1 model. But at least the AR1 model performs better than the AR2 model, so let's keep that with us. But for the sake of the comparison, let's still estimate ARMA 1.1 model, so at this moving average lag. We'll see that MI1 lag doesn't seem to add much of information into our model. So meaning that the MI1 coefficient doesn't seem to be necessary to take with. But to test about the possibility, could it really be the case that we have the unit route here in process? Let's run an F test. So here when we are testing that we have a unit proof, unit root, our null hypothesis is that in usually we test that our null hypothesis is zero, but when we want to test whether there's a unit root, we test whether it is one. So this is our unrestricted this is our restricted model. It is just AR1 model, and we are comparing that with the AR ARMA 1-1 model. And when we are testing the difference of when we are testing the does the restriction apply, and we get a B value that is so low, we reject our null hypothesis, meaning that which refers here that the we have a unit root. This refers here to, or suggests that we have a unit root in the process. This is basically F test we are performing and not a unit root test that you will be dealing this work during the lectures more closely. Next, let's start estimating the subperiod in question. And I'll try to speed up a little bit so that we can get these exercises through in good time. So first, we'll specify our subperiod, that is the period before September 2008, and then we'll estimate that spread by ARMA 1.0 model. And we get about the same results as earlier. The AR1 coefficient is null 97 and the its standard errors refers to the highly significant statistical. For the sake of comparison, let's run an ARMA 1-1 model. And the results are almost the same like before. The coefficients for the subsample are the same as for almost the same as for the whole sample. And by just by eyeballing the ARMA 1.0 process to ARMA 1.1 process, we conclude that from the statistical significance of the MA1 root, that is, it doesn't add much. It isn't statistically significant. So next, let's start running the forecasts. This is the recursive forecast. I'll just run it through without, because it is the same as we did earlier. And then I run the same forecast for the ARMA 1.1 process. The earlier was for the ARMA 1.0 process, and now we're calculating the forecast for the ARMA 1.1 model. And then we'll start to set about the unbiasedness of the forecast. So here, let's run a simple linear regression and check what's happening over there. So here, here we are testing that our null hypothesis is that there is no difference between there's no difference in the ARMA 1.0 model and its forecasts, implying that when the difference is zero, the forecasts are unbiased. And here we get a result that our p-value is so low that it refers to the that our result, that there's a bias in the model. Then let's look at the ARMA 1.1 model. And again, we conclude from the p-value that there is a bias in the model. When we reject the null, we reject that there is no we reject no unbiasedness, or to say it in another way, that there's a bias in the model. And to strengthen our intuition, let's run a simple F test to test the accuracy of the forecast, meaning here that if we are again testing the, if the null stays in power, it means that our forecasts are accurate or efficient, and if we reject the null, that means that there's a bias in our forecast. So again, we arrive into a conclusion that there's a bias in our forecast. And that was for the ARMA 1.0 model, and the same for the ARMA 1.1 model. And again, we see that there's a bias. And then we arrive at the C part. In the C part, we are asked to construct a Diebold-Mariano test using the mean absolute error. So to run this test, we have to, basically what we are testing, that smaller the error, the more accurate the model is. So to test the error, we take the difference of the forecast and the true values of the spread. And this is for the, in the first case, this is for the ARMA 1.0 model. And in the second case, this is for the ARMA 1.1 model. And here we happen to be in a good place, as we can use the already coded program in the R to run this test. So basically, we have here forecast errors of the AR1 model and forecast errors of the ARMA 1.1 model. And our null hypothesis is that these two models have the same forecast accuracy. So let's run the test. So the null hypothesis is no difference between the model. And as our p-value is below 0.05, we reject the null and conclude that there is a difference between the forecast accuracy. In the first case, we applied the mean absolute value, mean absolute error, like ask in the question sheet. And to strengthen our conclusion, let's run for the mean squared error the same test. So when our null is that no difference and we reject is, this means that there is a difference. But we could see here that when we squared our test statistic, that the p-value, it decreased. although it's below 0.05, it's pretty close to the critical limit. So it's always a good thing to try to find a little bit more support for the test performed. And that brings us to the D part, where we are asked to use the Granger-Newbold test to compare the ARMA 1.0 model to ARMA 1.1 model. And this test can be performed in the following way. I think we can skip what has been written in the notes and just run the test, because that's the important part. So we are calculating. So our null hypothesis is that there are no differences in the dispersions of the model, and let's calculate our t statistic and compare it with the probability distribution. And this is the p-value we got. So this is below the 0.05, almost 10 times, we can pretty safely conclude that these models have different dispersions. I think that was about it from my part. Alexandra, do you want to show anything from Stata? I think we have around 10 minutes still time.
Actually, nothing much to add from Stata, but just wanted to say that since Stata uses the maximum likelihood method, but not Euler's, the results just like a bit different, but like all the tests are possible also there, so maybe they can go through the codes on their own. So yeah,
yes, so actually to conclude this sixth exercise, this is our real conclusion that we get, that actually, our end result is that we have pretty safely found a unit root process in our stochastic series. And unit roots are something that you'll be discussing on the lectures this week on Wednesday or Thursday. So that's all, folks, and I hope you have a nice week, and we'll see you again next Monday. See ya.
Thank you. See you.